about last time. We've started talking, we're in the chapter about modeling. We talked about various types of models. Last class, I'm going to go through a little bit more of that before we start talking about evaluation. Okay, any questions? Yeah. I would say first principle models is how I like to call them, and data models, yeah.
But then, like, I was thinking about it, and I still feel that the first principle model somehow is a lot related to data-driven models.
Okay.
The principle behind it comes from...
So first of all, whenever there is a, a label attached to something, when you try to define a name for a category, it's often, you know, impossible to completely split these categories in a sense that makes sense. So what I mean by a first principle model is that there is a theory or a, basically a theory behind it, okay? And when I think about a data-driven model, I think that there are correlations behind it. That is probably where I would draw the line, okay? That there, you know, that if you have a reason why something is, you know, if you say the world works like this, and I'm going to build a model that governs the way that the world works, then that is a first principle model. Okay? If you are going to say, I don't really know how the world works, I'm predicting something that's messy and complicated and not, you know, a well-defined process, I'm going to take a bunch of variables that hope seemingly correlate with the outcome and build a model that hopingly predict something based on these correlations that I may not know why they're there or why not. So that's where I draw the distinction. So to me, in my mind, again, you know, whatever you say, is anybody one thing or another, okay? There's always, you know, a little bit of both, okay? But on the other hand, I think that there is a clear difference in how people think about things when they're thinking about first principle models versus correlation models. Any questions? Well, it helps me decide, think about how do I want to build a model for this thing. So one concept, we can say a computer scientist is this creature that drools and can only look at data and compute correlations and build something without knowing anything about the domain. Okay? And that's, you know, that's not an unreasonable way to do things. But often there are ways of thinking about your problem where you think you understand what the mechanism is by which the prediction should be made. And then your prediction should come into that. I'll talk a little bit about simulations today. But simulations, in my mind, are first principle models. You have an idea of what governs the process that you're trying to predict. And you're using that to kind of guide to build your model, as opposed to purely taking a look at you have observed instances and observed correlations and trying to match that. Any questions? Okay. So my goal here, I'd like to talk a little bit more about models and how I partition models and for thinking about them. And then I want us to talk about evaluations. Again, one thing I evaluated over the last couple of days were your progress, were your proposals. And so I want to talk about that at the end. So don't let me get away without doing that at the end. Any questions? Okay. So another, let's say, dichotomy of models that I think about, which are, again, you know, you can decide whether this is a perfect breakdown, is there is a difference between black box models and descriptive models. Okay? A black box model is one that basically gives you an answer and doesn't tell you anything about how it is making its decision, okay? A descriptive model will tell you why it is making its decision, okay? And to a certain extent, I would say linear regression models are descriptive because when you look at them there, it's a sum of terms that, you know, where there's coefficients weighting the more important variables more. You can figure out, if you look at an instance, if you said, let's predict whether Skeena a person or a car. You say Skeena's a car. Well, wait a second. Why is Skeena a car? And you know, you says, well, according to this, cars have four wheels, and it looked from this record like he had four wheels. And now you know why it made that mistake. Okay. Other models are less descriptive. They're pretty much impossible to tell what, why they are making decisions. So one story that I heard about, which probably isn't true, but it's a good story, was a lot of these neural network models, these deep learning models, are becoming popular. And one story I heard was that the Army had tried to produce a system that could tell cars from trucks, okay? And what did they do? They had a bunch of images of cars they photographed. They took a bunch of images of trucks they photographed. They trained the system that when you saw a picture of it, was it a car or a truck, okay? And it got very, very good at doing that classifying. And then they bring it out into the field one day, and it does terribly. And the reason why, supposedly it came out to, was they took the pictures of the cars on a sunny day and the trucks on a cloudy day. And what the classifier was doing was learning from the background, okay, the color of the sky, whether it was a car or a truck. Now, you guys could be able to imagine how this can happen, right? And again, in a descriptive model, you would be able to ask, why did this happen, okay? In a less descriptive model, it's a problem. And a good example of this, again, related to images that I find kind of interesting. Many of you, I assume, how many people have heard of deep learning? Everyone's heard of deep learning. This is the big thing these days. And one thing that is true is in many tasks, these neural network deep learning systems have gotten much better at making predictions than any system before it. And, in computer vision, particularly in computer vision, there were these large corpuses of images that got classified, and then they were able to build systems that could classify what an object was from any one of 1,000 classes, okay? On the other hand, someone then, a research group then said, well, let's see if I can build images that fool neural networks, okay, fool these things. So they took the champion image recognition system, and they created images that would fool it. According to, these systems, they were 99% sure that this thing was a centipede. Does everybody see it up there? And that 99% sure this was a centipede. Okay, a centipede is an insect with 100 legs, just for those of you who don't understand it. This was a jackfruit. How many people see the jackfruit? Okay, you see the jackfruit? I mean, in that picture, do you see the jackfruit? Okay, that I'm hoping, good, okay. Otherwise, I was going to assume you were some kind of neural network or something like that. Okay, so how did this happen? Okay, what was this about? Okay. Well, basically what they did was, once they had a great, a neural network that was the world's greatest image classifier, what they did was take an image of something that was a jackfruit, and they would add noise to it, okay? And they would add random noise, and if the random noise had it scoring better as a jackfruit, they would keep the random noise, and if it had it scoring worse as a jackfruit, they wouldn't, okay? And so basically, over time, they were able to train the images with the property they could fool the classifier. Does everybody kind of get that idea? So is it a sin that the neural network declared this to be a peacock? Is that a problem? Okay. You're saying this is something beyond what you're training for. What you're saying is these are not representative images of things. Part of it has to do with what is your use case. Is it a problem? Okay, people aren't giving you these things in general, okay, on things that people post to their Facebook page. So maybe it's not so important, okay? What I would say the big sin here is not that it was so confident on these obviously silly images. The problem was that the neural network wouldn't give you a reason for why it made those messages. You would like to have a model that would tell you why it was calling this a jackfruit, Okay, because if so, then first of all, you would know You would know how to improve the model. Okay, but in general, these kind of neural network things don't give you a way to do that. Okay, so that's what I mean by the difference between an opaque model and a black box thing and a descriptive model. Okay, any questions? We'd like our model to be descriptive. We'd also like it to perform as well as these neural network vision systems do. You know, can you use them for security applications? I suspect the answer is yes. Okay, I mean, so for example, if you want to use this as a security application, you have, you know, you're going to decide whether to let Skeena into the if somebody comes to the door and you want to decide whether to let them in, I can believe these image recognition systems are going to be perfectly good for, you know, accurate at doing that, and we'll be able to tell that it's me at the door and not one of you guys, and so they let me in. So some level of security, but I guess there's a limit to the trust level. At some level, you know, there's a question of, you know, at what point do you trust these things? If you're delivering cancer diagnoses by these things, do you trust it? Okay? Any questions? Yeah. So deep learning model is kind of a, you know, newfangled term largely for these neural networks, okay, which consist of layers of sort of simple, very simple classifiers or things working on features. And the interesting thing about them is they can have millions of parameters, and they seem to be able to learn reasonably good models despite these millions of parameters. So when you have a large amount of training data, really large amount of training data, these models can do something on them. Whereas, you know, a more constrained system like a linear regression system probably couldn't do very much given too many different, you know, it won't be able to learn a rich enough model. Okay? Any questions? Okay, good. And again, you know, when we talk about these black box things, these are basically based on correlations between things. We can argue whether or not correlation, as we know, does not imply causation. This one, the Dilbert one, is my favorite of the bunch. So you can read the Dilbert one quietly to prove that correlation is not the same as causation. Okay? Any questions? Okay, good. One aspect of modeling, which gets to my mind at this question of what is first principle or not first principle, has to do with whether your model is a one-level thing or a multi-level thing, okay? In a multi, you know, if you're have a purely a black box that takes it, you know, all the input in, and comes out with an answer, I consider that to be a one-level model. Just one model you're building. But in many cases, solving your problem really requires building different models, okay? And that thinking about decomposing your problem into what are the different sub-problems you can model is often, I think, a more accurate way to go about doing something than to go and just build a big black box. So at one point, we had talked about building a model to predict whether Apple's price is going to go up, okay? And one thing we could imagine is, oh, well, there's several different aspects to whether Apple's price is going to go up, okay? You know, one is the state of the economy. If the economy is in a depression, okay, Apple's price, stock price is not going to go up regardless, you know, to a certain extent, regardless of what Apple is going to do. So predicting what the future state of the economy is one modeling problem that you would want to solve. You would like to be able to look at a balance sheet data and decide whether a company is profitable or not. That is a separate modeling kind of a problem, right? And, you know, and then there's all these other kind of aspects. How has the price been bouncing around and things like that? But does everybody get the idea that models should have multiple layers if it's a complicated phenomenon? And if you understand what you're modeling, then, you know, you should be able to break out these different layers. Okay? Any questions? So on a sufficiently complicated modeling problem, you should have some kind of a structure of the sub-problems that you're modeling. Any questions? Okay.
So you might need different models for solving different
Yeah, so I would think in an ideal world, you would have different models for solving different things. Because, you know, that you've thought about, you know, different models may be appropriate for it. Okay? Any questions?
And what is the way to merge these?
Well, what is the way to merge these problems? One might be, again, there's different kinds of ways you can think about it. One might be you use each one of these models as different votes. You might use some of these models as parameters to a more complicated model. So for example, once you know whether the economy is going to be good or bad in the future, maybe that's something you feed to your time series modeling thing. Okay? Any questions? I know that's kind of vague. And in particular, let me talk about one class of models that does typically involve hierarchical modeling that I kind of like, which are simulations. Has anybody ever built a simulation before in their life? What did you simulate?
Let's say using Monte Carlo, whether something will percolate or not,
percolation model
for a conductor.
So this was doing some science-y thing. Okay, I'll call that science-y thing. Anybody else ever build a model, a simulation of something? Okay? I find simulations very, very good. And you know, my favorite simulation model was this one we built for betting on Hylai. And did I ever talk about this in here? Okay. How many people said I did talk about it? How many people say I didn't talk about it? Okay. What? Did I talk about it? Okay. Fair enough. But what was true was that when we were building this thing, okay, we did a Monte Carlo, this game that we were playing, is in some sense like basketball, like tennis or cricket or baseball, in that events happen in a sequential series, right? In tennis, there's different plays, different points happen, and you could model, if you wanted to predict who's going to win a match, one question would be to model how good each player is. And then if I know how good a player I am and how good a player you are, then we could simulate what's the chances of me winning over a game with you by playing a virtual game where we flip coins with those probabilities to decide who's going to win a game. Any questions? So when we built this system, which I describe in my book, which I like, okay, we ended up building several models that were a part of our simulation. One of it was a model for how good is a player. Can I get a sense as to how likely, I need a model that if I'm playing a point against you, what's the likelihood I will win that point? Then there was a modeling of the effect of the scoring system. It turned out that in this sport, the scoring system made a big difference, depending on what uniform number you were wearing. You had a different chance of winning because of some strange things regarding the scoring system. Okay? We had to model that. We had to model what is it that bettors like to do? Bettors seem to prefer betting on certain numbers than other ones. And bottom line is that building a simulation like this and building a proper modeling, there were several different events, different kinds of feedback we could put into it. Any questions? Okay. Any questions about models or any of these kind of things? Okay. Let's say I'm going to leave that and get into evaluation. Okay? Any questions? Okay. So what I'd like to now talk about is when we build models, how do we evaluate them? Okay? And we need to have statistics to judge how good our model is. Okay? And there are, you know, different ways of evaluating classifier models versus where you're trying to predict one of whether an item falls into a particular class or not. How many of you think you're doing a classifier project for your project, where you're building a model that's kind of picking a class, you know, trying to take something and figure out what class it's in? Which one are you guys doing? Give me one. What are you doing? To try to decide if a city bike ride was business or pleasure type of thing, right? Anybody else have a classifier project? Yeah? What's that? To try to predict whether this team is going to win or lose a match, right? Okay? That could be a classifier thing. Okay? So when we evaluate classifiers, there's sort of several metrics we can build from the four possible things that can happen. First, we'll talk about binary classifiers, where there's only two classes, which seem to be the case in those examples. And we'll talk about other measures later for more complicated classes. So we say that a true positive is when there was a positive example labeled positive. What do I mean by positive or negative? Typically speaking, when you have a classification problem where there are two different classes, okay, we would then call the smaller of the two positive if they were identical classes, occurred with equal likelihood. We would say that pick one of them arbitrarily. Maybe like the football, the game is a win, is a positive class. Okay, the home team wins. Okay, and when we have a positive example that our system labels positive, we call that a true positive. When our system has a negative example and we label it negative, that is a true negative. True positives and true negatives are good things. Does everybody see that? Now, I get confused with false positives and false negatives, but it's kind of important to keep that in mind. A false positive is one where a negative example got labeled as positive. Okay? And a false negative is where a positive example got labeled as negative. Any questions? So one way to think about it that I think is going to be an example I'm going to use at a couple points today is to think about a threshold classifier. What is a threshold classifier? Let's say that you take all your training and your thing like this and boil it down to a score that's going to be higher positive and lower if it's negative. Okay? Perhaps this is in like a logistic regression type of thing, right? But so you ultimately take your statistics and get a measure of how likely is it to be in a positive class. We are kind of faced with, if you look at all your training examples, here's a histogram of the negative examples by your score. And here's a histogram of your positive examples by score. Does everybody kind of get that idea? If you have a good scoring function, those two distributions are going to be far apart. Does everybody see it? How would we evaluate how good a classifier is? A classifier on such a thing is going to typically pick a threshold and decide that everything less, if you have a score less than that threshold, it's going to be negative. And a score greater than that threshold, we're going to call it positive. Does everybody see that? What is a metric that we would use to try to set the right place to draw that line? Does everybody kind of see that? For any threshold, we would have something that is good at separating, that is going to have some ability to separate the negative examples from the positive examples. The true negatives and true positives are here. The part of the negative distribution that lies on the wrong side of the line are the false positives. And the side, the part of the positive distribution that lies on the wrong set of line is the false negatives. Any questions? So these kind of classifiers should make sense. The key question is, how do you set the threshold? Okay? Any questions about that? And it should be that you set the threshold to optimize some kind of a scoring metric, but what is the right scoring metric to choose from? Any questions? The threshold here, what it looks like, is about 167, right? That's what this line here is supposed to represent. And once you have two distributions of examples, you have a scoring system, and you have here a frequency distribution by those scores. That's what the histograms are. Setting any value as a threshold will label some negative examples correctly, some positive examples correctly, and give some the wrong answer. And the question that comes up is, where do we pick the right threshold? I think we agree that 167 looks better for many cases than a threshold of, let's say, 190 pounds. Well, let's say I had set a threshold of 180 pounds. Why might I want to set a threshold at about 182, let's say 182 pounds? In this case, there's no false positives. Does everybody see that? Can anybody think of a world where would want a classifier where I didn't have false positives? Yeah? If I'm predicting cancer, would I want to say no false, what does no false positives mean? That would mean a no false positive situation, if positive meant cancer, would mean that I never told anybody they had cancer when they didn't have it, right? But I would miss a lot of people who did have cancer. Does everybody see that? So if that's the case, I probably don't want my cancer classifier to not scare, be trained so it doesn't scare anybody, okay? But let most people die, okay? Yeah. Perhaps I would want to be on this side over here, right? Where I'd want to be able to set it at a point where almost all the cancer people, if I set my threshold down around 150, almost everybody who, let's say, had cancer would be pegged as having cancer. The trouble is I would scare a lot of people. Does everybody see that? So what is the right place to set it depends upon your evaluation metric. Does everybody agree with that? Okay. So what are the standard evaluation metrics? Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Is that a valid scenario? So that would mean like for value of 170, you have both true negative and...
Yeah, so what this is saying is this is a hard enough problem that there is not a perfect separator between them. If I had to try to figure out if someone was a man or a woman from their weight, okay, I couldn't find a perfect separator for that. Is that clear? And likewise, with most cancer tests, I bet you that you cannot find a place to separate people perfectly. There are definitely going to be false scares. What we would like, of course, our dream would be that our classifier had set things up so there was no overlap between the distribution. But it's not clear we always have the power to do it. Right now, with this case, I'm assuming we have we've come up with the discriminative function. You know, we've come up with the scoring function, and we're trying to set the right thing. Actually, what I'm really trying to do is to talk about evaluation metrics. It should be clear that for any classifier, there is a knob to set here, and where you would set that knob depends upon what metric you choose is important for your evaluation. Any questions? I mean, if you have multi-class classifiers, it's going to be different in knowledge. We'll talk about multi-class classifiers later, but there's different kind of measures of accuracy and stuff like that. We
always evaluate true negatives and true positives based on the actual data, right? So we have the actual answers, and then we say that, okay, this was a true negative.
Right. So in this case, we had actual answers. In order to tell whether something is a true negative or a true positive, we need to know the right label on it. Right? We have a classifier. We're trying to, we know what the right label of the examples are. We're trying to be able to come up with a computational method to predict the label. And here's where we're evaluating how well we predict the label.
So then how can there be an overlap? Is it possible that a label can have both true positive?
No. But let's think of the weight, the men, women, height, weight case. I am going to say, you know, not sure, if we ask everybody here whether they should be listed as a man or a woman, okay, presumably we'd get an answer, right? Now, we would also, let's say we also ask for a weight on them. There will be a distribution, okay, where if we take a look at the men, there's going to be a distribution. Men are typically bigger than women. There's going to be a distribution of women, right? These are women, these are men, okay? Can we predict, given the weight, whether someone is a man or a woman? You say no. The answer is yes. Obviously, you can do it. Even if you don't give me give me any information about it, can I predict whether somebody is a man or a woman? The person outside that door, is that a man or a woman? Can I predict it? Yes. How would I do it? Perhaps a random simulation model where I flip a coin, right? How accurate is it really, the question is, right? And so the question is, what is the accuracy we can achieve by a given model? That's why we're talking about evaluation in here, okay? Ideally, we want perfect separation between classes. But recognize that, again, the training examples are properly labeled. We assume that they are properly labeled. This is sort of reflecting if we have a score that we're assigning for positiveness based on our classifier, okay? This is what we are getting as the distribution. Any questions? Yeah.
Over here, like, shouldn't we know, like, we should have labels which would tell us, like, this is the false positive line and this is the false negative, and that seems like important, right? Like, if you have some value which is beyond, like, the false positive range, you know that when you're doing a classification for that value, it is going to be accurate.
Well, okay, wait. So again, let's just make sure that we're understanding each other here. Again, I'm assuming that the x-axis here is a score of merit from your statistics, right? In the one variable case of predicting gender from weight, okay, that was one, okay? You could imagine a more complicated thing where you learn a big complicated score based on, you know, either just build a scoring system or something like that, such that we think that the score is going to be higher if it's positive, right? Once we have a scoring system, coupling our scoring system with our training example or evaluation examples will give us something like this, okay? Among the positive examples, there will be a distribution of scores. Among the negative examples, there's a distribution of scores. Ideally, they would be separate, but ideally, everyone would be rich and good-looking, right? Okay, and you can't always have that, right? So what we're saying here is we want to be able to evaluate our scoring system on this example to decide whether it's good or bad. How good is it? Okay. And to help tune, in the case of a threshold classifier, where the threshold is. Does everybody see that? We could set the threshold here or here or there. And which is better depends upon what we want to do with it, right? Any questions? But we need to have some kind of statistic that will take the number of true positive, false positive, true positive, true negative, false positive, and false negative, and give us a measure that is an appropriate statistic. Any questions? So there are several different statistics that are naturally computed from these counts. The first one is accuracy. Accuracy is true positives over true negatives. It's the number you got right over the total number of guesses you made. Does everybody get that idea? So when I think about classifiers, I like to think about the monkey. The monkey is one who just guesses. What would be the accuracy of a monkey, okay, who guessed, you know, either positive or negative on each example? Okay? Half the time they would, you know, if they're guessing it, if let's say half the examples are positive, half the time we would get those positive examples right, right? And if half the examples are negative, half those examples we'd get right. If almost all the examples were negative, okay, the monkey would get half of those right and half of the positive ones right. All told, the monkey would get an accuracy of 50%. Any question about it? Okay? So accuracy is a reasonable metric. But we got, again, that's appropriate in some times, but not in other times. Any questions? Now, when the positive examples are, number of positive examples is much less than the number of negative examples, accuracy does not prove to be a good measure of a classifier. And let me try to convince you of this. Suppose we have a cancer world where, let's say that you're giving a cancer test and 5% of the people who take these tests have cancer, okay? the monkey would randomly say, the monkey would be 50% accurate because he's declaring half the people to have cancer and half the people not to have cancer, right? I mean, let's just be precise. Suppose we have a world where 5% of the people have cancer and 95% of the people don't. Okay, these are the healthy people, right? What would the monkey do if he just picked randomly positive and negative? Half of these guys would get cancer, would be called cancer, and half of these people would be called, it would be called healthy. Of these guys, half of these people would be called healthy, and half of these people would be called cancer. Is that right? We're getting a lot of the cases right if you look at it. We're getting 50% of those cases right, but nonetheless, you wouldn't want to trust the monkey for this kind of a decision. Is that correct? In a case like this, we would like the monkey to be very precise when it says it's got cancer. So precise is saying, how many times did I get true positives? Okay, true positives are when I said that you have cancer and you do have cancer. False positives are which ones? Those are the ones, are the ones that were negative, where I predicted negative, but they had cancer, right? So precision is going to be the fraction of people who have cancer who I labeled as having cancer. Does everybody agree with that? And the monkey would say that of the people who had cancer, let me just think about this for a second. Okay, because I always get this false positive thing confused. Okay? What would the precision of the monkey be? Okay? Okay, so let's think about it. Suppose the positive class was having cancer. Okay? In this case, what is the breakdown? If 5% have this, what would the monkey do? These are going to be the true positives. These are going to be the true negatives. Does everybody agree? What are the other distinctions? I'm sorry to say. Okay. So a false positive is where a negative example got labeled positive. So this, I believe, is the false positive. Does everybody agree with that? And this is going to be the false negative. Does everybody agree with that? Now, what is the case here for precision? Precision is going to be the number of true positives, which are these guys, okay, over the number of true positives plus the number of false positives. Does everybody see that this is going to be about half of the items, right? Okay, this is going to be something about 2.5% over about something like about 50%. Does everybody see that? So this is about a precision of 5. I may have my numbers a little bit wrong, but I think, does everybody agree that this is a precision of about 5? Okay? Any question? So if we're trying to do, if we have classes that are different, precision is a better measure than accuracy. Any questions? Right. When I say that you have it, how often do you really have it? Okay? That's really what it's saying. Okay? Any questions? Recall is a case where, we want to say how often are we being right. Okay? So suppose one of these patients had their tumor right on, very, very visible. Okay? You could look at this guy and any one of us could tell that they had cancer. Right? Maybe it had the word cancer on it or something like that, okay? You could imagine a classifier that on that one person, I could look at all these people and say, okay, only this guy that had the word cancer on it was cancer, right? Then that would be a very precise classifier, right? Because I'd get one case out of the one person I said was cancer, I was right, That would be as perfectly precise as you could be. But the trouble is, there's a lot of people here who have cancer who I am not classifying as such, right? You would want a classifier to make sure that when the real cases are labeled properly. Recall is a statistic about measuring when the real cases are measured properly. Okay? So that's the number of true positives over true positives plus false negatives. Okay? What would that be in this case over here? So for recall, it's the true positives, which are over here, divided by the true positives plus the false negatives. Does everybody see it? So this says of all the people who got cancer, how, you know, what were the true positives? Okay, that you know, how many of the people who had cancer did I say had cancer? Any questions about that?
So like it should be one, right?
If it's ideally, if it's perfect, anybody who has cancer, I say they have cancer. How can I make a classifier that will give me a great recall? Can anyone give me a classifier that will give me great recall? What? Declare everybody as having cancer. Does everybody kind of get that idea? If you declare everybody as being cancer, having cancer, then the true positives over, well, the false negatives would be zero, right? So it's easy to get perfect recall. But if we get perfect recall, do we see that our precision is going to be low? Right? So we have to sometimes decide whether we want precision or recall. There are two different kinds of things. Any questions? And sometimes it matters more than others. Okay? Any questions? A common statistic that is used to combine the idea of precision and recall is something called the F-score, which is essentially the product of precision and recall. Okay? And this is basically the harmonic mean of precision of precision and recall. If you think about it, let's think about our cases of what we would need. Assuming that this is the in order to get a I think of the F-score as being the product of precision and recall, okay? That's the way that I usually think of it. It's written differently here for some reason. But if I think about it, the product of precision and recall, if they're both 1, the F-score would be 1. Does everybody see that? If we're very precise, that whenever we call something, we always get it right, and we never miss anybody, then that's great. Suppose we had very, very low precision, like our monkey, or if our precision was 0, then the product of 0 and anything is going to be 0. Does everybody see that? So basically, the F-score, the way it works is that to get a good F-score, you want to balance both precision and recall equally, both of them being good. Okay? Any question about it? Okay?
Yeah.
You know, you're saying this thing, I'm thinking in terms of, okay, to be honest, I don't have any good answer for you here, okay? But what I'm going to tell you is, what should be clear that is good or done by F-scores is that if you do, it rewards you for being good on both, equal on both. That's kind of, I guess, the important thing. And if one of these things is much worse than the other one, it disproportionately weighs it down, okay? So it rewards you for being versatile, okay? Any question about it? That's probably not as satisfying as you'd like. But bottom line, what is satisfying about an F-score is if you want one measure for your system, the F-score is probably your best single measure, okay? Any question? Okay, good. So what are the takeaway lessons? Okay. Accuracy is misleading when the class sizes are different, okay? And in many applications, they are different. Because when you have classes sizes that are very, very different, always saying the big class is going to give you a high accuracy score while giving you a useless system. Okay? High precision is very hard to achieve when you've got very, very small, one group is very, very small than the other. Let's think about the problem of identifying terrorists, okay? You know, you guys, some of you guys fly, some of you guys, when you fly, the FAA, you know, the security people have to decide whether or not you're a terrorist, right? Now, ideally, it would just say this person is a terrorist and always get it right, okay? But recognize that that's a very difficult problem because there are so few terrorists. Does everybody agree? Letting the bad guy on the plane is a big mistake, so you don't want to, you know, you want a high precision thing. But if the class size is very, very small, it's extremely hard to achieve a high precision. Does everybody kind of get that idea? And so that's one of the reasons why it's tough to do these kind of things. Any questions? And finally, like I say, it's worth looking at all four of these statistics, but F-score, if you need a single number to deal with, F-score is the one to boil it down to. Any questions? Okay, good. There is one other statistic that is commonly used for measuring classifiers, particularly these kind of threshold classifiers that you see here. Let's say that we have we have taken our statistical data and come up with a score that's supposed to separate the two classes. How good a job does that score do? Does anybody know how to get rid of this black thing? I'm terrified to hit exit. Not that. What should I click on to do it? No? Okay, sorry, bunk. Presenter view? No. Okay. That's why we leave it up there. Okay, any question? Let's go back to presenter. Sorry. Trouble. Okay. That's why it's stuck. That's why you're stuck with it. Okay. Anyway, does everybody get this idea that we're back in a world where, whenever I touch the mouse, it comes back. Okay. A score of merit, okay, that's supposed to separate the two classes, okay? How can we decide if we have a good scoring system or not? One way is to look at what is the true positive rate and the false positive rate as we scan our threshold over it, okay? So let's take a look at this thing. Let's imagine that this threshold line over here, we're going to start on the right and sweep it over, okay? The true positive rate is going to be what fraction of the things that we have classified as positive really were positive. Right? The false positive rate are the things that that we classified as positive that were wrong. Okay? Now, let's say we sweep our line over here where everything on the right we're declaring positive. At this point on the system, if the line is over here, I am going to claim that there's very few things we are declaring positive. But we're almost always right about it. Does everybody see that? These are the ones that got the highest positiveness score. And if our positiveness score is any good, the things we classify as most positive hopefully are positive. Does everybody see it? So as we sweep over to the other side, what we would expect is that at the beginning values, we get a case where the false positive rate is the false positive rate, okay, is what fraction of false positives have we, okay, what are the number of false positives versus the number of true positives? As we slide over here from left to right, we're going to get more and more true positives from right to left. Let me try to do it. From right to left, as we slide over here, it should be clear we're going to get more and more true positives and also eventually more and more false positives. Does everybody agree? If our classifier is good enough, we should basically get more, the true positives should be ahead of the false positives. Does everybody kind of get that? So what the ROC curve is saying here, the true positive rate is what's the fraction of the total number of true positives that we have labeled so far, positives that we have labeled correctly, okay? The false positive rate, what's the total number of things we labeled positive that we were incorrect about, okay? It should be clear that if we set our classifier all the way on a threshold on this place, all the things that were true positives, we got right. So all the things that were positive, we got right, correct? If we said that anything that is bigger than 120, everything is positive, anything that was a positive, we got right. Unfortunately, everything that was negative, we got wrong. Does everybody see that? So what we would expect to happen here is that as we slide these things over, okay, at the beginning, our rate of getting true positives is much greater than our rate of getting false positives. Does everybody kind of agree with that? And that at the end, okay, once we've slid it all the way over, okay, false positives are the true negatives that we would have declared incorrectly. At the end, all the true positives will have been called, all the positives would have been called positive, and all the negatives would be called positive. Does everybody see that? So at the end, the false positive rate is going to be 1, and the true positive rate is going to be 1. Does everybody kind of see that? So the ROC curve is kind of a way to encode the accuracy of all of the different possible parameter settings. Any questions? Threshold settings. Any question?
How do we calculate this rate, true positive rate?
So the true positive rate is going to be, for any session, is what's the number of true positives over total positives. Okay? That's really what this is. The true positive rate is the number of true positives, okay, over the total positives. The total positives were the size of this distribution, right? The true positives here were the ones that were on that side of the distribution. Once we move our threshold over here, all the positives would have been declared positive, right? So the true positive rate would be 1, or 100%, you know, 1, or you multiply by 100, it's 100, right? If you look over here, the false positive rate is going to be 0, because none of the true things are going to be declared, none of the negatives will be declared false. By the time we move it all the way over, all the negatives will be declared false. Does everybody see that? So what's interesting about this curve? This curve tells you where you should probably set your threshold. Where is the logical place to set the threshold? Okay, it depends somewhat upon your application. But what's kind of the points where you're going to want to set your threshold? Okay? Pretty much, here's where when you're going up, you're going right, and when you're going horizontal, you're going wrong. Does everybody see that? And because of how these things have been computed, these are monotonically increasing functions. The curve is always going to go either up or down or right on every step. And somehow, the right threshold is the point on this true positive, false positive rate that you want to be able to look at. Any question about it? Okay. Every one of the dots represents a different threshold. That's kind of, I guess, the point here. Is that this is a function that is going to be a staircase kind of a function. Because every point you slide the threshold a little bit to the right, you're going to capture another example. Is that right? Or maybe another couple of examples, however much is in that bin. Right? And if you got that example right, you went up. If you got it wrong, you went to the right. So any questions? Okay? And so what's interesting about it? Okay? The claim would be that the monkey, okay, if you had a function that was not very good, if the scoring function was produced by a monkey and the monkey was just producing random numbers, okay, to be based on, making the decision on, the monkey's rate would look like this, that the number of false positives would equal the number of false negatives at any given point. And that would represent this red line. An ideal classifier will have all the positive examples before it has any negative example. Is that right? Everybody see that? So the ideal thing would be a ROC curve that went all the way up and then all the way over to the right. Okay? Any questions? Yeah. Receiver operator's archaic term, this came from actually people who were looking, originally doing things with radar signals and stuff like that. So it doesn't mean anything to me, okay? But what doesn't mean to me is that the way to think of it is, this helps me set my knob. My knob is my threshold here, right? And I can realize a system that is anywhere on this curve in performance space. And based on this curve, I can decide how many false positives to false negatives do I want to see. Okay? Any questions?
So basically, in this graph, you want less number of false positives and more number of true positives. So that would be the steepest point.
Here is a place where I am getting, at this point, I've got 60% of the true positives correctly labeled. And I'm only mislabeling 10% of the negative examples, right? So that seems like a pretty good trade-off, okay? On the other hand, if I really need to know the find out which examples are positive, I might want to take another, move it a different point on the curve. Any questions?
Like, do we take the maximum or what?
Taking here would be bad. This is a threshold where I'm not declaring anything to be positive. Taking a position here would be bad. That's where I'm declaring everything is positive, right? Generally speaking, there is a certain amount of false positives I'm willing to tolerate. If I say I'm willing to scare 10% of my patients that they have cancer, by looking at that, this says I can get correctly labeled 70% of the cancer people. While scaring 10% of the people. Okay? Any questions?
So since we're taking only true positive and false positive, is it similar to precision?
It's sort of a little bit, it's sort of capturing precision and recall.
How recall?
Well, because this is the question of ultimately, this point here says we've classified all of the examples right. This is a question of what fraction of the positive examples have you classified correctly. So it's capturing really a recall. This is a recall among the positives, and this is a number of mistakes on the part of the negatives. Okay? Yeah.
The highest point in this ROC curve corresponds
to 1, 1. Yeah, that one. Right. So at that point, the threshold is probably out here. This would be, the threshold would be over here. 0, 0 was the threshold over here. 1, 1 was the threshold over here. Ideally, this point on the curve is hopefully probably something like the threshold over here. Okay? That's where we've got... It should be clear that if we're doing it right, we should be getting a lot more true positives than we're accumulating false positives. Okay? Any questions? One reason to compute this is that the area under this curve gives you a measure of how good your classifier is. Okay? If we thought about it, if the monkey classifier that randomly assigned positive or negative to things would be given by this red line, the area under the red line is like 1/2, right? 1/2 of the unit square. The perfect classifier would shoot all the way up, getting nothing but true positives as we swept over, till at some point we had hit all the true positives, And now everything else from that were negative examples, right? What would be the area under the perfect curve?
One,
right? So the area under this curve is another score that you can use to judge how good your classifier is. Any questions about that? Okay. We were some talk about how do you deal with multiple class systems. Do any of you have projects in here where you're classifying things into multiple classes? Okay. Does anybody have a project where they have lots of classes that they're trying to recognize between? Okay. Here is an example of a class where you had an OCR system where there was a digit, and you're trying to, you have an image of a digit, and you're trying to decide whether it's a 0 through a 9. Right? That would correspond to 10 classes that are possible. And it should be clear that classification problems get harder when you have more classes. When you have a multi-class classification thing, one of the most useful things to build is, what you call it, a confusion matrix, which says how often were things that were should have been 5 called a 2. According to this, there were 3 things that were 5s that should be called 2s. Does everybody see that? And in this case, there were 11 things that should have been 5 that were called 3s. Does everybody see that? Why would a matrix like this be useful in a multi-class classification system? Okay. What? It gives you insight into the mistakes that you're making, right? What are the correct predictions in such a matrix like this? The main diagonal, right? You like to see a big fat main diagonal, right? But the claim would be that where you have the biggest numbers here represent the hardest cases, the case for your classifier, the ones that it's doing wrong, right? And often seeing what the mistakes in the classification are, okay? It's important to help debug your system, right? So again, with OCR, if this is supposedly real OCR data. What numbers? You know, I can see an 8 and a 2 being pretty similar, right? Because if you have a serif here and a serif there, it kind of closes to an 8, right? Any questions about that? So if you have a multi-class classification system, part of your evaluation had better be one of these confusion matrices. Any questions? Now, when you have multiple class system, one thing, what would be a single number describing whether your system is right? Okay? How well your system is performing. An obvious thing to do would be to give yourself credit for a correct classification if you got the right answer. Does everybody see it? And your accuracy is, we could still imagine true positives and false negatives and all this kind of thing, where we give you a point for getting, you know, a true positive is you guessed the right class that it actually was, and otherwise it was a mistake. Okay? Any questions? Now, the problem with this is when you have many, many classes, the chances of getting the class exactly right is very, very small. Does everybody kind of see it? One of my students was working on a project recently where they had a 50,000 classes. They were trying to identify who had written something, and there were 50,000 possible classes, right? What would be the chance that the monkey had picked the right class? It would be 1 in 50,000, right? What would be the likelihood that you would be able to, any system would be able to pick the right class out of 50,000 classes? Should be very, very small, right? So if you measure the accuracy as the number of times you get it right, you're going to get a very, very, very low answer, okay? And low answers are bad for a couple of reasons. One, if I have a low accuracy rate, I get discouraged, right? But more than that, I learn very, very little, okay? Because if I have a system that is giving me an accuracy rate of under 1%, let's say, and I change my system, it's going to be hard to recognize If it's a too hard a problem, it's hard to recognize when I'm making progress. Does people kind of get that idea? Suppose, let's say that, you had to build a classification system to predict somebody's weight, okay? And you're only correct if you're accurate within, you know, a gram, okay? You could build a classifier and you run it on a million examples, and you're going to be wrong on every single one of them. Does everybody agree? See that? If you now go and and tune your system, if it gets better, you might still be wrong on all of them. Does everybody kind of get that idea? If you have too low a success rate, it's hard to tell when you're making progress. Does everybody see that? It's not just that you want to impress the boss, okay? It's that you'd like to be able to have your system such that I can tell when people are making progress, when one system is better than another. And in order to do that, you need to have a success rate that is high enough. Okay? Any questions about that? So one way to give you credit in a case where there's a large number of classes is typically your system is going to have a probability for each class that this item is in that class. Does everybody kind of think of it? So suppose that instead of having, if I have 50,000 classes, suppose I give you credit when the class you say is one of the right class is one of the 1,000 classes that you thought were most likely to be it to be. Now the monkey under that test would get 1 out of 5, right? 1,000. I think I'm saying that. Okay, you can tell I'm getting funfered here. But what is the point? Okay, suppose there are in fact 50,000 classes in this problem. Okay, and I have to make a decision as for an item as to which class it is. That's what my classifier does. If my classifier gives me a statistic for each class as to, for this item, what's the likelihood that I think it is in each one of these classes? It doesn't just give me a label, but it gives me a confidence, or it gives me a what's the likelihood of being in there. I could now sort the classes for this item from most likely to least likely. Does everybody see that? If I draw a threshold and say I'm going to give myself credit if the class is in the right class, the right label for this item was one of the top, let's say, 1,000 classes. If I have 50,000 classes, the likelihood of guessing something is in picking the item as being in, if I have 1,000 guesses, I should be right 2% of the time. Does everybody see that? Now there's a measurable chance of me succeeding. And if I want to make the problem easier, I give myself credit for a larger number of classes, right? If I want to make it harder, I give it credit for a smaller number of classes. Okay? The claim is that the top K success rate can be a more accurate judge of how well your system is doing, or a more useful judge of your system when the problem is too hard. Okay? Well, typically, assuming your classifier, if you have a bunch, we haven't talked about how you build these classifiers, but you can kind of imagine that if you have a multiple class system, typically, you're going to come up, what's the probability that the item belongs in this class? Does that kind of make sense? So let's say that the probability of being in the most common class was this. The probability of being in the second most common class was 0.08. Does everybody kind of get the idea? For each class, if we get a probability that it's in there, we could sort these probabilities, and thus the 1,000 with the highest probabilities are, if we have to choose 1,000 possibilities, those would be the labels we would pick. The claim that I'm saying is that that it can sometimes be in a hard enough problem, using this top K criteria is a better judge than just using the top, did you get it right or not? Any questions about that? Okay. Well, an ROC curve, now you've got to measure, let's just think about it. The ROC curve thing is assuming a world of true positives and false positives. It's not clear to me what the true positives and false positives are in this case.
The diagonals are true positive, others are false positive.
Anyway, for now, let's just think that the ROC curve is for, what you call it, for binary classifiers. Okay? Any questions? Okay. There are other error statistics, and I can tell this is getting a little bit boring. Okay. Some of you are going to have projects where you're going to be developing, in some sense, regression systems, systems that are going to try to predict the value of a continuous type instead of a classification. Does anybody have a project in mind that they were going to predict a value? Yeah, which was yours? So let's say you're trying to predict the number of bikers on a particular day. Now your quantity is the input, you know, you want to get a number. What would be a way to, you need some kind of a statistic to take your forecast and the observation and tell you how wrong you are, okay? And there are a bunch of different measures that we can use, okay? The absolute error is just the difference between the two. The relative error is the difference between them divided by the scale of the observation. Saying that, how many bikers there you have on Citigroup, Citibike, how many bikers will you be wrong on a particular day? If you're wrong by 10,000, is that a good prediction or a bad prediction? What?
Depends
upon how many bikes there are. That's kind of, I guess, the point, right? So this is really one that will tell you in terms of the percentage of it. If you know how many Citibikers there are in a day, I can tell you whether an error of 10,000 is good or bad, okay? And anyway, this gives you a way to score an error on one example. Typically, the mean of these errors or the mean square of these errors is a way to evaluate the whole system, okay, on all the examples. Any questions? Okay, fine. Now, when you're building these evaluation systems, one decision you're going to have to make is whether or not, how to take your data and partition it into training data and evaluation data. And this is a tricky business if you don't have a lot of data. If you do have a large amount of data, typically people will take the data and put 60% of it into training, 20% of it into testing. By that I mean stuff that you would use to test your model while you're building it. And then set aside 20% as a final data that you're only going to look at the very, very end of the process. To tune your model, you would use training. To compare different models you're building, maybe you'd use your testing data. But you'd like to set aside something at the end, okay, that you never look at until you're really ready to prepare, do the final evaluation. That's a way you know that you're actually accurate. Any questions? There is this notion of out-of-sample predictions, which is an important thing. The best way to evaluate your model is when you have data that came in after you started building the model. Okay? So when I looked at my quant shop projects, why did I have my students predict something that happened in the future? The real reason was to make sure they weren't cheating on some level, right? They had to make a prediction about something they didn't know the answer to. Often in your projects, you're going to be taking a big data set, okay? And it's very, very hard to judge how well it's going to do on new data, because typically people pollute their evaluation data by taking a look at it. Somehow they look at it a little bit beforehand. The best way to judge a model is with data that didn't exist or that you didn't have or you didn't know about when you started to build your model, okay? If not, you've got to keep the rigor of keeping something separate that you don't open till the end. Any questions? Okay. Fair enough. And like I say, there are many errors that can come up when you mix your evaluation data. Any questions? Okay. The last advice that I will give you, and then I will get on building an evaluation system, is that all of you for your projects are going to have to build an evaluation system. Your evaluation system is going to be a program that basically is going to take your evaluation data and your model and come up with a score for it, okay? One thing that I strongly urge every group to do is to build a single command program to do it. What does that mean? It means type evaluate model and quality of evaluation comes out, okay? It's kind of important that when you're tuning your model, you want to evaluate it repeatedly on your test data, okay? And what I find is that if people do not have a single program that they run that produces all the evaluation metrics in a way that it's easy to run, people, you know, tend not to do it. So the input is going to be to your evaluation program is your evaluation data with whatever the outcome value is. It's going to call as a subroutine your current model, and as output produce all the summary statistics and distributions that you need to get a report as to how well your thing does. Any questions about that? I guess the thing I want you to do is make sure you build something that gives you more information than just a summary statistic at the end. You would like to show an error distribution, not just what was your precision, but something like if you were doing something that was a regression system to try to predict the value. You don't just want to give me a mean squared error. You want to get a whole distribution of errors, produce a plot of it, okay? The key thing, like I'm saying, is basically make sure you develop a system that will give you your full reports every time you change your model. Any questions? Okay. Any questions? Okay, I'm going to end this. This lecture didn't feel very good, so I'm going to apologize for that. But I'll end it sort of why I like to talk about out-of-sample predictions. If you tell a joke, okay, jokes work better the first time than the second time. Does everybody agree with that? Okay, there's one joke that I will tell you about today. You guys know there's a holiday coming on Monday. What is the holiday? No, isn't it Christmas? Okay, no, Diwali. No, that's not it. Okay. I always think that it's Christmas that's coming up next. And why is that? Okay, does everybody see why? Okay, as any computer scientist thinks that Halloween is Christmas? Yeah? Octal and decimal. Does everybody see that? That in base 8, 31 is the same as base 25 in decimal, right? How many people thought that was funny? Very few. Okay. Now, let me try to tell you this again. Okay? Does everybody see how computer scientists can get confused between Christmas and Halloween? How many people think that one was funny? Okay, the answer is less, right? And the reason is because once you know what the answer is, okay, you know, it isn't the same as before. You can't put yourself back into the state you were before you told a joke. And likewise, when you're evaluating models, if you don't rigorously segregate your evaluation data from what you're training on, everything's going to get very confused. Any questions? And that's why, ideally, if you can evaluate it on data that comes later that's out of sample, that would be good. Which of you guys have a chance for your project to evaluate yourself on out of sample data? Okay, all you Citigroup people, bike people, right? So one thing that's true is that you're busy, you all claimed your data set now. People will be cruising on their city bikes for the next couple months. Does everybody see it? So one thing that would help me believe your model, if you had a way of validating it, okay, if you train a model on this data and validate it on the stuff that came after you had built your model, that's one way of maintaining some level of honesty. Does everybody kind of see that? And likewise, if anyone was building a gambling system or any kind of a prediction to predict who's going to win sporting events or things like that, it's important that you be able to run it on stuff that didn't exist when you were training it to avoid problems. Okay, any questions? Okay, so I'm going to say sorry about that because that didn't feel very energetic. But okay, what I wanted to talk about for the rest of it, I did grade the project proposals. And what I wanted to do, I want you to pick up your project proposal for your group. My grading scheme was the following. The people in the 90s, I felt, had a great idea of what they were doing. They clearly had an idea of what project they wanted to do. It was likely to work. They started working on it.